This is Invest Talk, above average investing for the average investor. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Money Manager Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our Monday, November 17th, 2014 edition of Invest Talk. And we only have about a month and a half left in the year. And today's show, or today's talking point, is called Should You Beware of Alternative Mutual Funds? So that's going to be something we're going to touch on throughout the hour. Alternative mutual funds are kind of they're touted as cutting edge and this newfangled way to invest that's maybe better than it has in the past, or a way to diversify your portfolio further. So we're going to talk about them and what are the pros and cons and whether you should be invested in any of them. Because there's different types of alternative mutual funds, not just one type. There's multiple types out there. So we welcome you to our Invest Talk show this Monday. And, you know, what we're promoting here every day is above average investing for the average investor. That's the title of Steve's book. And that's what we try to portray to everybody, that you can do better than the average person. And that's really not that hard, because the average person doesn't do very well because they act with emotions and they fall into traps that really cause them to make money losing mistakes time after time. And what we try to do is help you follow time-tested methods for reducing risk as you prepare for retirement and improving returns overall. You know, we want to maximize your performance. But we got to match that performance with risk tolerance and being able to help you find opportunities in the marketplace. Now, part of our job is to caution you about current economic issues and market trends that could trip you up. And one of them is the search for dividends is in the no interest rate environment. And with interest rates so low, investors are constantly searching for yield. We've been talking about this for the past couple of years. And you had the taper tantrum in the second half of last year. And a lot of that has reversed because interest rate increase has come back a little bit. Has actually, interest rates have gone down this year, which is kind of a shock to a lot of people. But they haven't erased the entire move of 2013. They just erase some of it. So the issues that came up late last year, and now they've been erased kind of a lot this year in the interest rate sensitive sectors. Well, you know, I think that was a precursor to what could happen in the future. And a lot of people are chasing yields in multiple asset classes. And you have to understand the risks that each one has. You know, REITs and massive limited partnerships are different than corporate bonds and big blue chip dividend paying stocks like Procter & Gamble. So it's important for you to have an idea of what the risks, drawbacks, rewards are when you're going out there and searching for yield. Because the low interest rates are pushing a lot of people into asset classes that aren't usually the best for people that are trying to be safe. And that's what most people are when they're lurking for yield. They're trying to force themselves to get a portfolio that creates yield for them. Usually they're trying to be safe. And for the most part, dividend yielding assets are safer than non-dividend yielding assets. But that doesn't mean they are completely safe. You know, one example that a lot of people don't understand are foreign companies. You know, dividends are taxed as qualified dividends, 15 or 20% depending on your tax rate. But there's something called a foreign tax withholding, and many times the home country withholds 15% or more of the dividend that you're getting paid out. In a normal taxable account, you're able to recover that charge, through what is called a foreign tax credit when you file your taxes. And in a in a tax deferred account, such as an IRA or 401k, there's no way to recoup that withholding tax. So not all foreign companies have foreign tax withholdings, however. It depends on which country they're in. You know, master limited partnerships, that's another special category. Dividends are taxed at your ordinary income tax rate. Not only that, but you have to file a separate tax return on behalf of that account, or the K-1. So keep this in mind when you are investing in your retirement accounts. Real estate investment trust. The biggest difference in income from a REIT versus a typical dividend is that income is taxed at an ordinary income tax rate as well. This makes it even more advantageous to own them in tax-deferred accounts because you're not filing that special tax return like you are with master limited partnerships, right? So REITs are better in non-taxable accounts. Master limited partnerships are better in taxable accounts because either way you're getting taxed the same rate. Now, while tax rates are not the most exciting part of the investment world, they still need to be taken into account because they ultimately dictate how much money goes into your wallet. So what money questions would you like answered today? Let's get to the phones now. Our line is always open. Here's our first question of the day from our 24-hour listener line in 888-99-CHART.
Yeah, this is Adam Thomas from Fort Wayne, Indiana, and listening to you on the podcast. When someone invests using a discount broker, I know the discount broker is covered with SIPC up to $500,000. Should an investor be concerned if they have more than $500,000 invested with one particular broker? And number two, maybe a scenario best explains my concern. If an investor, say, buys $1 million worth of Apple using a discount broker and the discount broker goes bankrupt, I thought the investor was buying the underlying stock and it shouldn't matter what happens with the discount broker. So somewhere I'm confused. Please advise. Thank you.
Sure, that's a great question. I don't think you should be terribly concerned if you have more than that SIPC limit in a particular brokerage account. It all depends on the broker. A small broker with not a lot of financial backing and maybe not a lot of history as a broker, that might be an area where maybe I wouldn't have more than that SIPC protection. Right? It is $500,000 and $250,000 in cash, limit on cash. That's the insurance protection for SIPC. Now he's asking about, well, what happens if the broker goes bankrupt and you have $1 million in Apple? Well, that's, yes, you don't have to worry about your money in Apple if they just go bankrupt. But what SIPC covers you from is fraud, right? So remember MF Global? Remember MF Global? This was a few years ago. This was a commodity broker. It's a commodity broker. This wasn't SIPC insured, I don't believe. I'm trying to remember the exact details. But there was fraud there where they took money from individual accounts. And so a lot of people lost money because there was fraud, right? And they didn't have the insurance to cover them. So I don't think it was SIPC insured. I don't remember the exact details, like I said, but I think a lot of people did lose money because that was fraud. You know, bankruptcy is another story. That's just, you know, the company's insolvent. And remember, your money is held separately, you know, or your money is your money. It's like you said, it's your shares of Apple. So it really, you just have to worry about fraud in that case, not them going bankrupt. So I hope that kind of explains that situation. If I had more than $500,000 in a brokerage account, I would say it just really depends on the broker. You know, if it's, I don't want to tout anyone, but I'm saying, you know, TD Ameritrade, Scottrade, you know, the big ones out there, I don't think you probably have to worry. Or at least I would be less worried than another broker that might be super cheap, but they haven't been around very long, and they don't have a history of operating in boom and bust cycles. I would like a brokerage firm that's been around and be able to survive, times like 2008, 2009. So that's my take, and I hope I give you a good explanation of the difference of what you need to worry about. Now, the funds are appealing to investors looking to avoid market highs and lows, but there are downsides. Should you beware of alternative mutual funds? That's our main talking point today that we're going to discuss. But I also have some other points or other discussion points that I want to touch on. One is some warning signs for the global economy. Global economy, this is a report out of London, and it's talking about some of the issues going on in the global economy, from emerging markets in Japan to Europe. There's a lot of issues going on, and how is the world economy going to be able to handle all that? So we're going to talk about that. Talk about long-term care as well. Should you buy long-term care insurance? What are the pros and cons? 10, and then also 10 quotes from Warren Buffett. I always think these are interesting to discuss and at least ponder when you're growing as an investor. And I think everybody should be growing as an investor. And Warren Buffett is one of the best in the world in history. And I think it's always good to rehash some of his quotes, things he said over the years that might help you become a better investor. And then we'll talk about the industrial output. Industrial output, that was an economic report that came out today, and I'll probably talk about that coming up shortly. So that's what's on my mind. Those are the things that I want to discuss. But ultimately, I want to hear from you. I want to know what is on your mind. So give us a call at 888-99-CHART, and we can answer your questions, whatever is on your mind in the money matter world. So let's take a quick look at the market today. The S&P closed up 1.5 points. The Dow closed up 13 points. The Nasdaq closed down 17.5 points. And the Russell 2000 was also down as well. What was that? That was down about almost 1%. Almost 1%. So that was definitely by far the weakest index. This is the fifth day in a row. It's an interesting stat I read. Fifth day in a row since 1970. 1970. You're talking, 45 years. 45 years in the market where the S&P closed up or down less than 1/10 of 1% for 5 straight days. 5 straight days. So you can see how really nothing's happened in the market over the last 5 days, at least on the S&P. But I think you always have to look at the underlying, what's going on underneath the surface of the market. And I talked a little bit just now about the Russell 2000 and the Nasdaq. Those are both down decent, and those are always good indicators of what's going on in the underlying market. And the fact that those are down while the S&P is flat, that shows you that really momentum is waning, and at least in the short term, you're probably more likely to see downside than upside. The advanced decline line on the Nasdaq on the NYSE was negative. There was more 354 more declining names than advancing names in the NYSE. So it showed you that the breadth of the market was negative overall for the day. And the NYSE did close, but the NYSE closed up 2 points. Really not much doing either. So overall, flat day, and that was on the back of poor industrial output. Poor industrial output numbers. It dropped 1/10 of 1%, and that was because of vehicle production drop and less demand for utilities and mining companies. And that is why you had poor economic numbers out this morning. And really, why you didn't. It was kind of weird. It was kind of a weird day because also Japan fell into a recession. The second quarter, there was a big drop in GDP because they increased taxes there. And the analysts were expecting them to have a nice bounce back quarter in the third quarter with a positive GDP number. I think it was up, supposed to be up 1% or so. Well, it was down 1% or so. So it shows you two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth for Japan, and that equals a recession. So those are the two negative economic numbers, but there was a lot of M&A activity. You had a buyout of Allergan, I think it was, and then you also had Baker Hughes. Baker Hughes got bought out by, I think it was Schlumberger. They were the ones buying out Baker Hughes. So positive from the M&A activity standpoint, but negative from the economic report activity. And that is why you kind of had a flat day. Some positives, some negatives, and really not much going. Now you can listen on the go to Invest Talk on the TuneIn Radio app. It's free, and you can download it to your iPhone or Android phone anytime right there on investtalk.com.
Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. If you'd like to have access to our ever-expanding library of Invest Talk webinars, it's easy, just as easy as joining the Invest Talk Insiders. It's free, and you can sign up anytime on investtalk.com. Now more Invest Talk. Bring your money question to Justin right now. 888-99-CHART.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Let me just quickly get back to the industrial output numbers that came out today, because I think they're important to touch on. Like I said, the industrial output dropped 0.1%. Analysts were expecting a rise of 0.2%, and they actually revised September's reading down from 1% rise to 0.8%. You had a drop in production from the automakers, because the sales of cars is actually slowing a little bit. You had good production out of the business equipment sector, increased 0.6% after a 0.4% drop in September. So good turnaround there. Consumer goods output fell 0.2% last month, and that was a lot of because of the autos. Utility output decreased 0.7% last month. That was I always find utilities pretty interesting, because that utilities apply to a wide range of industries, you know, from businesses to individuals as well. And you had a pretty decent drop, 0.9% last month in mining and mining production, and that includes oil. And a lot of that's due with the fact that oil prices are now down to $75 a barrel when it comes to West Texas Intermediate. So it shows you there's a marked, I don't want to say a big decline, but you're starting to see some weakness in a lot of in a broad range of sectors. And there's really only one sector that actually held up decently. So not only anything, you know, big alarm bells going off, but it should be something people take note of, that industrial production is coming in weaker than expected. Now let's talk a little bit about our main talking point today: alternative mutual funds. Alternative mutual funds, and this is a new asset category, pretty new asset category. And the reason it's getting touted by a lot of big institutions is because the strategies have high fees. And they love high fees, right? And the sales pitch around these type of funds is pretty enticing, because they say, you know, it's non-correlated to the overall market. And, you know, in the past, 14 years, we've had a pretty meager return on stocks, because we've been in a secular bear market. And so people don't really want assets that are correlated to stocks very much, right? Why would you if returns haven't been so great? So they're looking for alternatives to typical equity funds, and that's why they call this area of the marketplace, this new area of the marketplace, alternatives. And what these funds do is they use strategies and investments similar to those that hedge funds use. And usually hedge funds are only accessible by the uber wealthy. And so they say, well, the uber wealthy can access these strategies. So why not use the same strategies on a broader fund scale, right? Bigger scale, and offer them to the average investor. And what they usually invest in are derivatives, distressed debt, options, or private debt, as opposed to public debt. And the alternative fund market has gotten really, really big, $300 billion in assets as of May of this year. In 2013, almost $95 billion flowed into these types of mutual funds, which is five times more than 2012. So there's a lot more money going into them. So I'm going to talk about this a little bit more and show you that there's not all alternative funds are created equal. There's a cornucopia of different types of quote-unquote alternative funds, and they employ different strategies, and some are more attractive than others, and some have higher fees than others. So I'm going to talk about that a little more coming up. But first, let's get to Eric in San Francisco. How are you doing, Eric?
Hey, Justin. How are you?
Doing well. What can I do for you?
Good. Hey, I wanted to talk to you about Schlumberger. Mm-hmm. I know that's probably a stock that a lot of people have been hearing about recently in the past couple of days, simply because of the Halliburton and Baker Hughes announcement.
Yep.
But I wanted to find out sort of how you see the company moving forward. You know, I mean, does the recent acquisition or merger of those Baker Hughes and Halliburton, does that pose a real viable threat to Schlumberger, or is Schlumberger in its own little world and they'll continue to dominate the oil drilling market?
Well, Halliburton and Schlumberger combined will be about, let's see, Halliburton and Baker Hughes. That'll be about the size of half of Schlumberger. Right? So Halliburton right now is worth $40 billion. Baker Hughes, I think the buyout is in the $30 billion arena. And Schlumberger is at about $123 billion. So it's about half the size. You know, these are such dynamic companies. And granted, they're oil drillers and exploration companies, service companies. And really what comes down to is really just oil prices. I don't think that Schlumberger is going to be affected too much by this merger, because they are much bigger. They have much bigger, they're still going to have a good scale. And this merger might help with the scale. So we're going to go to break real quick, and I'm going to address this after the break. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART.
We continue now with Invest Talk, and you're invited to bring any money question to Justin right now. 888-99-CHART.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. And Eric from San Francisco is asking about Schlumberger and how much the merger of Halliburton and Baker Hughes would have an effect on Schlumberger. And I think it will have some effect on Schlumberger, but I don't think it's going to have a dramatic effect. You know, there's definitely going to be some synergies between Halliburton and Baker Hughes, and efficiencies, and you know, improving pricing power and things like that. But Schlumberger is still a giant company. They're still the biggest in the industry, and ultimately, their success is going to be driven by oil prices. Oil prices continue to go up, and they rebound from this, you know, mid-70s level. Schlumberger will be just fine. But if oil prices languish, they get a small bounce, which they probably will in the short term get a small bounce. But if they start to get down in the 60s and $50 a barrel level and stay there, then you're going to have some issues with Schlumberger, and all the whole industry is going to have issues. Is it going to affect Schlumberger's profitability long term? Like I said, probably slightly, but I don't think it's going to be. It's not going to dramatically affect their prospects long term. Okay. I hope that answered your question. So let's get back to our talking point today about alternative funds. And I talked a little bit earlier about how alternative investments are, and alternative mutual funds are becoming more popular, and how $95 billion flowed into them in 2013. And that's about a third of the total number of assets that are in this sector, or this area of the market, as of May of this year. Now, alternative funds employ very complex strategies, and the biggest issue is one size does not fit all, because the risks vary between different types of strategies. Remember, alternatives are not just one type of strategy. There are multiple types of strategies. And there are a number of alternative funds that try to mimic hedge fund strategies. Most of them just simply are not very good, and they typically carry higher yearly fees. A lot of them carry 3 to 5% annual fees. And regular mutual funds usually hang around, equity funds, hang around the low 1% to, you know, maybe mid 2% on the high end. Now, you know, a lot of people will say they're a diversifier and that investors can protect themselves should the market go south. And it will stop people from losing, you know, 50% of their portfolio. Maybe this alternative asset can go up when the market goes down. The biggest issue is that not all alternative funds go up when the market does go down. They don't always zig while the market is zagging. They're not all designed as an inverse play. Some are just designed as being uncorrelated to the broader market, meaning that when the market goes up or down, this asset class is going to do whatever it's going to do. Now, there are different strategies that are employed. There's long short funds. There's merger arbitrage funds. There are what was the big one? It was managed futures funds. That was touted a lot after the 2008 financial crisis because they did very well, because they were short commodities and certain asset classes that went down, and they went up. And so everybody started falling in love with them. Well, since then, they haven't done very well. So, you know, how attractive are they? Well, to me, I think the best ones out there, the best strategy, is probably the merger arbitrage strategy. It's the best type of strategy I see in the alternative space, because there's it's pretty black and white. They see what a company is getting bought out for, and they make sure that, remember, when a company gets bought out, like Baker Hughes got bought out, right? Baker Hughes got bought out today, and it's trading at $65.21 at the close today. Well, there's a certain price that they're going to get bought out for. There are some risks there when it comes to regulators maybe denying the merger for particular reasons. So there are some risks there. But what a merger arbitrage fund does is they go in there and say, okay, they're going to buy it for X, and it's trading for a certain discount, usually a small discount to that price. And they'll go in there and buy those shares up and just wait until they get bought out, and they'll make a small profit. And whether the market goes up and down, as long as that merger goes through, they're still going to make that money. And they do this over and over. They try to diversify, obviously, because there's mergers going on all the time. And to me, that's the best type of alternative strategy out there. Most of the other ones, you know, managed futures. I've had a lot of managed future fund managers come and sit in our office and try to convince us to buy those for our clients. And I just have never really found a great need or a strong attractiveness to them. Because sometimes they work, sometimes they don't, and you really never know when they are going to work, and you really don't know when they aren't going to work. It's just kind of a coin flip, and I don't operate with coin flips, and I don't want to pay high fees for coin flips, especially. So the only alternative fund I would look at is a merger arbitrage fund. Now, our podcast listeners from all over the world download our program. So for these long-distance listeners who listen to at their own schedule, we have our 24-hour listener line. It is always open at 888-99-CHART.
Yeah, this is Don from Endicott, New York. I'm a podcast listener. I have a question. I find myself trying to look at an ETF the same as I do a regular stock. Could you please explain how to analyze an ETF as opposed to a regular stock? How would you look at that and look at its value and if you want to invest in it? Because I find myself trying to look at it as a single stock, and I know I should do that. So could you please explain the difference on how to evaluate those two? Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, well, first, a single ETF it's completely diversified, right? It's diversified over whatever industry that is or index it's following or whatever. So automatically you look at it differently because it's diversified. You know, one earnings report isn't going to kill, make or break that stock. You know, it might move that industry in the short term. So for example, you know, SMH, I remember there was bad earnings report out of Microchip Technologies. That was back in early October. And the SMH got really crushed, but it only went down from closed the day before those earnings came out, closed at 48.80, and it closed at 45.57. So it went down, you know, 4 or 5%, where Microchip went down, I think it was like close to 20%. So you can still get hit. It depends on what ETF you're looking at. You know, a broad index like the S&P 500, that's diversified over giant amount of stocks and diversified throughout industries. There's many industries within there. Then there is, you know, particular sector ETFs, like I talked about, the SMH, the semiconductor ETF. There's, you know, ETFs that go that cover a transportation index or a certain sector of the economy. And those are a little riskier because you can have one-off earning events that affect that whole industry, but less so than individual stocks. So you start off there. And then you have to look at the sector as a whole. You know, is it making higher highs or lower highs? Is it making lower lows or higher lows? What are earnings going on for the entire sector? What are the things that broadly can be good for the sector? You know, from economically, whether it's expensive energy, you know, that's good for energy producers. But it might not be so good for transportation stocks. What about particular countries and their GDP? Is that area doing well? Doing poorly? And what are the countries? What are the companies that operate in that country? So when you're looking at an individual name, you have to think of those things. You know, multinationals. Whereas a sector or a broad index, you know, you have to worry about that a little bit, but not too much. So, I mean, those are just a few of the differences. There are many, many more. So don't think of an ETF anything like an individual stock. They're very, very, very different in the way you analyze them. And that's just, like I said, a few of the differences, but there are probably two dozen more. Let's go to Mike in Apple Valley. How you doing, Mike?
Pretty good. I was wondering if you could tell me what's going on with Petrobras. It's gone under $10 now, and I just wondered. I mean, I didn't get to read some headlines that I read, the story from the headline, but it said something about a scandal.
I didn't see anything about a scandal. You're looking at PBR, right?
Right.
Yeah, they've gone. This has been a pretty ugly sell over just the past 2.5 months. Beginning of September, it was trading over $20 a share, $21 a share or so. Now, like you said, it's below $10 a share, $9.33 a share today. There's two things that are wrong. One is oil prices. Oil prices are going down dramatically. Two is Brazil. Brazil's market has not been doing very well. So you've had a double whammy there. The value of the Brazilian real has gone down. The whole Brazilian market generally has gone down. And then oil prices have gone down. So you've had kind of a triple whammy with PBR, and that's why it's been getting hit so hard. You know, is it going to continue down? I would say probably. It's hard to know the exact bottom of a name like this. Do you own it, or are you looking to buy it?
No, I was looking to buy it. It's like a $35 billion market cap, right?
Let's see what it's at now.
$35 billion?
Let's see what it's at now. PBR, let me bring it up real quick. About $60 billion market cap. So it's still a large, very large company.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't mean it's necessarily safe. I mean, the size of it, you know, there's been very large companies that have gone under. I'm looking right now. There is, let's see, a whining probe into alleged corruption at Petrobras has ensnarled another former executive. I guess there are some. I haven't really done a lot of research on Petrobras because, you know, oil prices have continued down. I just haven't really wanted to touch. We haven't really wanted to touch that whole area, and especially, you know, Brazil and oil. That's a double whammy. Not something I want to touch. And then you have the scandal on top of that. You know, could this be the bottom? It could, but I'm not. There's nothing that's telling me that this is the bottom yet. And spark that, and there was massive volume last month, and usually massive volume does mark some sort of a bottom, but I'm still weary because it's continued down this month, and we're over halfway through the month. So to me, I think this probably continues down below $9, probably in the $8 range. Where it stops, I couldn't tell you. I really have no idea where this is going to stop. It's a high-risk name. Are you getting it probably cheap? Sure, you're probably getting it cheap. But, you know, you have to be willing to handle a lot of volatility in the short run. Are you willing to handle that volatility?
Yeah, you know, if I bought it, it would be a long-term, probably at least 6 months or so. And I just thought, man,
yeah,
a
see,
of
I would, days. I would need to have a longer time horizon. I would say more like five, 6 years, not 6 months. Because 6 months from now, it could easily be much lower, and I think it probably will be lower 6 months from now. But 6 years from now, I'd probably say it'll be higher.
Okay.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Let's go to Nick in Hayward. How you doing, Nick?
Yes, sir. How are you, sir?
Doing well. What can I do for you?
Good show.
Thank you.
I'm thinking about buying Alibaba. Uh-huh. What's your take on it? Do you suggest it or not?
Well, this is a recent IPO, and you know, this is it's an interesting company, a good company, I think, overall. The problem right now is it's just uber expensive, and that's typical for an IPO. And when I say uber expensive, I don't mean the car company Uber. I mean massively expensive. It's trading at a P/E ratio in the 200s.
Oh.
You know, this is not a very attractive name on a valuation standpoint. And earnings growth has been decelerating. You know, a year ago, earnings were growing 144%. Last quarter, earnings grew 15%.
Oh.
So, you know, and earnings supposed to go 21% this quarter, 21% next year, 36% in 2016. And I'm just not willing to pay this steep of a price for a name like this. And there's been a lot of hype around the name.
Right.
I don't like buying hype. Historically, buying hype is a terrible thing to do, and it's hard to find much bigger hype than around a name like Alibaba. So I would say no, I would not be buying Alibaba.
Where would you consider getting in there? About what price?
I don't really, honestly, I don't have a price at the moment. You know, if you're talking about valuation, I would say $60 a share.
Oh boy.
You know, that's when I would say I consider it. But, you know, if it gets to 60, you know, they have to reassess it and where's growth and, you know, what's valuation like then? And there's a lot that goes around, you know, that number. And it's such a new issue, it's extremely hard to analyze. And that's why we don't really touch IPOs because there's usually a lot of hype and usually overvalued.
Right. Right. Maybe buy a few now and then wait for some time.
I mean,
and
you,
buy a few more.
You could do that and it could continue up, but I doubt it. So I would stay away from it. Now we're moving into the last segment of the hour. Let's see if we can get your questions answered before the day is done.
Thanks for being a podcast subscriber, and we do want to hear your investing experiences. We've all grown over the years through our experiences, good and bad. You get to be anonymous, and the rest of us will enjoy knowing that we're not the only one to make a turn when maybe we should have gone straight. So we hope you'll join us on the podcast. Thanks for listening. This is the Monday, November 17th edition of Invest Talk with portfolio manager Justin Klein. Why do certain investment companies do better than others and survive market waves? Philosophy is the horse, strategy is the cart. That's our talking point on the next Invest Talk. Please join us then. Of course, there's still plenty of time to get in touch today. 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to Lucy in Los Angeles. How are you doing, Lucy?
Hi, good. Thank you.
What can I do for you?
Hello?
You there?
Yes. Hi.
Yeah, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. What can I do for you?
I want to know if it's a good time to buy IBM stock. It hit a 52-week low from what I saw, and I read some articles about it that, you know, they're working on some really amazing technology. So, what do you think about buying IBM stock?
Well, first I have to ask, what is your time horizon? Are you looking to buy this for as a long-term investment or like a trade for, you know, 6 months or a year? Or what, you know, what are you thinking there?
I'm thinking about 6 months to a year.
Yeah, see, I think 6 months to a year, it could be it could be okay. I don't think it's going to be great. I think they still have some work to do in turning around their business. But it is cheap. And I think on a longer-term perspective, I wouldn't say it's screamingly cheap. It's cheap. We do own it in our balanced income program, so you know we do like it longer-term. We don't think it's going to turn around and go gangbusters, like I said, in the short to medium term. But you know, longer-term, it is cheap. So it kind of depends on you know what you're thinking. If you think you're going to you know make 20, 30, 40% in the next year, I doubt that. But, you know, could you make, you know, 5 to 10%? Sure, it could bounce, you know, modestly higher and you get a nice 2.7% dividend. I think that's probably more likely. Are there going to be better names in the next year? Absolutely. So it just depends on what you're looking for.
And by longer term, Justin, what do you mean?
Three to five years. You know, when we look at a name like IBM, big blue chip name, paying a good dividend, while their business in the short term is struggling, and when I say struggling, I mean revenue down 4%, which is you know for IBM, it's not a huge deal. Earnings are down 10% year over year, so they are working through, I think, a time where they have to transition some of their businesses that are they're being threatened by cloud computing and a lot of other competitors out there, and they're just going to have to rejigger their offerings in the marketplace. And I think they will, and I think over time they will get back to growing their earnings. But, you know, it's IBM. It's a $161 billion company. It's hard to move that ship in a substantial way, and it takes a while for it to really move. So I don't think you're – like I said, I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but I think 3 to 5 years from now, they will right the ship in a more substantial way, and you'll get back to earnings growth. But currently, you know, with very modest – I mean, earnings decline, I don't think you're going to really get a big return out of this name.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. What about Disney? I own Disney. Do you think it's something that will continue going up, or is it something I should sell and then get back in when it drops?
Well, I do think Disney is expensive. It's a great institution. Has great names, great brands with, you know, ESPN and all the media rights that they own, and obviously Disney characters. I mean, it's a fantastic business. Disney movies. It's pretty well diversified. But it is expensive here. So it's like, it's another one, depends on your time horizon. And I think, you know, 6 months to a year, it'll probably struggle, but longer term, okay. it will do well.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Justin.
Thanks for calling, Lucy.
All right, thanks for your show. Thank you.
Now let's, I think we have a couple more minutes. How many minutes do we have? Just about a minute left. Well, what can I talk about in a minute? I would like everyone to kind of go online and research what the Prime Minister of the UK said, David Cameron. And he wrote an op-ed in the Guardian newspaper today, and he said that there are red warning lights flashing for the world economy. And for those multiple reasons. And I think everyone should go to Google, find that piece, and read it, because I think it's important to understand what's going on globally. We're in a global economic environment today. We're not on an island like we were, you know, 100 years ago. It's much, much different today. And even 30 years ago, it's much, much different. So go there, read what's going on, and you will be much more informed about the global economy. Now, before we close the hour, a reminder that Steve will be in San Ramon on the 19th. That's a couple days away, this Wednesday. He'll be meeting with listeners for individual portfolio reviews. And if you'd like to set a time on that day to meet with him, just go to investtalk.com, click on the Make an Appointment button. I'm Portfolio Manager Justin Klein, and on behalf of Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP Financial, we thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again on the next InvestTalk.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.